Hi, everybody. It's Meredith Tyler. This week's guest is very well known in the Silicon Valley area. He's one of those, things he touches turn to gold all the time. His name is Mansoor Salameh, and he is the CEO and founder of a company called Frontspin. Now, some of you may not have heard of Frontspin, but I think you'll soon be hearing a lot more about them because they have a really nice solution that's built on a platform that I'm comfortable with and that I think is really foundational, which is the telephone. So we'll talk about that later, but I wanted to introduce Mansoor to you, and we're going to talk about topics that are relevant for growth and relevant for scaling, which is what all of you want to do. So welcome to the podcast, Mansoor.
Thank you, Mary Lou.
So tell us about, first of all, the history of how you're an engineer, obviously, must be. And so you came up through the ranks of engineering, and then how did you become now an entrepreneur, a serial entrepreneur who creates companies and sells them?
Right. That's a good question. A lot of people find it unusual. For me, it was kind of a haphazard happening. So like you said, I was an engineer by training. I was actually my first job out of school. I was a project manager for a company called, at the time, Anderson Consulting, mm-hmm. and is now called Accenture. And I was managing a project where I was implementing a technology for a large Fortune 100 bank in the contact center. And that technology was developed by a company out of Silicon Valley called Genesys. And so that's how I first ran into, I would say, a startup. Genesys convinced me to leave Accenture and join them. And as a project manager, they had a lot of projects. And I was always trying to do the right thing by the client. And they staffed me out, actually, on the first project at Wells Fargo, and we implemented a successful project for them. And then they gave us an order for five times the initial order that Genesys had. So Genesys, looked at me and says, okay, maybe you want to do something else other than project management. And, speaking French, they sent me overseas, and I started the Southern European office for Genesys. We ended up going public. But I never really thought of myself as a salesperson or an engineer. I always thought of somebody who could find a solution that is valuable for a prospect or a customer. And I guess that's the sales approach I would say an engineer would have. But that's in short how I end up, quote unquote, introduced to sales. We ended up growing the Southern European offices, and we ended up going public, and it ended up being, I think, the outside of the U.S. was the largest office that Genesys had.
So you've always had that flair, that unique combination of, being very technical, understanding the bits and bytes of things, and really getting under the skin of the client of what their needs are, and then translating that into, okay, this is an opportunity from a sales and marketing perspective that we can utilize to get more business.
Right. And it's actually even translates more on one-on-one. So mm-hmm. sitting down with a customer or a prospect, right. understanding their requirements, understanding their challenges, and solving those problems. Because at the end of the day, I think the best customers you have are the customers that after you've solved their problem, they're also obviously delighted and using your product or the service you sold them. Mm-hmm. I've always approached it as let's understand how can we add value to that customer, almost from an engineering or product perspective. So how can we add value to this customer? And sometimes the product is not a fit and just move on. But a lot of times you can add a lot of value. So that's kind of the approach.
So you're coming from a process background, and I really identify with that because of the work that I do. I'm also an engineer, software engineering though. I have a computer science degree. But I've always looked at sales as a, one big problem, a puzzle to solve. And I like to apply process to things. Whenever I used to say this to my team, whenever we have to do something more than once, chances are it can be programmed or there's a process behind it. So, you know, process is for me that kind of overarching methodology that I really like to put into place. We were talking offline, and I think the topic for today that would be very interesting, because I just had a conversation with a colleague who went through this process of starting with a number of folks on his sales team. The product took off, and then he had to scale very quickly, and they were finding that there was a lot of stuff that was broken in the process that they had thought was the wonderful process for a smaller team. But as they started growing and adding more people and more divisions, and then they went global, it just all kind of fell apart. Luckily, he had he had a good sense to hire people who were self-directed and really helped them by fixing some of these things. Could you talk to us today about process and how process is utilized? And when you have to really look at it at certain areas or certain levels of growth and how that affects how well the process is run.
Right. And that's a very good topic, Mary Lou. So the way I look at process is in two buckets. So I put the in everything. It's not just in sales or the sales process, but it's also the engineering process, the product process. It's also a little bit the marketing messaging, which is also very important, and that plays a lot into the sales process. Yeah. And the two buckets are you're either in a search mode or you're in a scaling mode. So when a startup, this is my third startup. So if you take a look at the beginning of last year, we were more in a search mode. We were trying to find what is the right prospect, what is the right feature set, what is the right approach, what are the right value propositions that we match with prospects. So we were more in a search mode. So the process had to have some volume so we can validate some of those metrics, but it didn't make sense to have 100 people in a room scaling it, because if you are still in a search mode and you try to overscale a process, you will end up scaling the wrong thing, because by definition, when you're in search mode, you don't have something that works. And then there's the other aspect. Once you have a process that works well, then you want to scale it as much as possible to get value out of the process. Or if it's a process that doesn't need scaling, you want to make it as efficient and automated as possible. So there's these two buckets that I put things in. Are we in scaling mode? Or are we in search mode? And there's always, it's never a black and white. So even at every stage, you go from one to the other. That's, I think, a good framework of how we think about different processes. And for example, right now, we are approaching, we're scaling some processes. We're actually increasing our sales team and increasing our SDRs. We're actually adding a number of SDRs starting actually at the end of the month. Mm-hmm. So that's very exciting for us. But that's after we validated some of the process of prospecting and some of the process of qualifying and the messaging we validated. So what I think a lot of people do, not unlike the story you mentioned with your friend who ended up scaling, a lot of people end up scaling maybe with a process that's not fully figured out.
Exactly. I can remember sitting in a boardroom up in Seattle when I was working with the startup. The board picked what seemingly was and turned out to be a very arbitrary number of growth, 3x. We're going to grow from 3 million to 9 million or whatever the number was. I can't remember the actual dollar value, but there was no basis for that. And of course, the VP of sales bought into it saying, sure, we can do that. We just need to add more, whatever, sales reps, AEs, you know, servicing. But you're right. I mean, it was a monumental, just worst case scenario, never met the numbers for each of the quarters, because at the beginning of this whole process, we were probably still in search mode and we didn't have the ability to really consolidate a process that was predictable and consistent so that we could scale.
Right. No, that's very true. And if you take a look at the processes, some processes have headroom and some reach capacity. Mm-hmm. I mean, for example, my previous company, Contactual, was acquired by 8x8 a couple of years ago. And they had a number of different processes, but they had reached capacity on the SMB. So they built this process and that's it. They couldn't buy more leads for the SMB. They couldn't get more lists of target customers to reach. So what they did is they built a mid-market team to go after mid-market. And that mid-market team had a very different process than the SMB team, right? Mm-hmm. And then now the mid-market team grew and it's they went through their own search process and their own scaling process. And then now they built an enterprise team. So the interesting thing is that you never stop searching. I mean, you could be maybe on a particularly great market that you have one process, you figured it out, and for 50 years you keep scaling it, but that's usually not what happens. Typically what happens is you find a process that works for a segment, you scale that, and then you look for the next segment. And the segment could be either a vertical or it could be also a size of a company. And for instance, right now, what we have here at Frontspin, we have, if you will, two segments. We have one which is more the segments that we can sell remotely and implement remotely. And we have more of the enterprise, which are larger customers or 100 seats and above, or 100 customers and above, where we have to address their requirements and their buyer's journey in a very different way than the smaller guys, which are much more cookie cutter. And so we kind of are aware of that, and then we kind of filter out the larger ones so it doesn't slow down the velocity of, I would say, our bread and butter today, which is more the 100 and below customers.
So you mentioned within the two buckets, the search bucket and scaling bucket, there are certain parameters or categories that you like to look at. You mentioned that, there's a marketing and sales component. There's the actual sales conversation itself. There's developing unique selling propositions by product and probably by prospect. How do you go about defining what these things are? And are they, when you're in search mode, are the same things looked at in scaling mode? Or are you adding more things as you move into scale mode and newer processes as you move?
Yeah. So for me, you always are improving and tweaking the process, even when you're in scale mode. In scale mode is usually like more than half of the process is nailed down, but you always want to improve things. And then at that point is when you spawn off different targets or different verticals you're going to go after or different markets. But if you take a look at during the search mode is usually when you validate the vast majority of the messaging, the vast majority, okay, how's this price? Let's do different pricing. Should we do a transaction-based pricing? Should we do a fixed monthly fee pricing? Those are the kind of things that you validate, in my opinion, in a search mode. Mm-hmm. And typically what happens is you will tweak them as you scale because you'll see things that you didn't see necessarily at the volume of search, but you will have I would say most of the framework there. Now, what happens is it's important that even if you go into scaling mode, that you always have one person or a couple of people dedicated for searching for the next frontier, whether mm-hmm. it's whether it's a different market segment or a different vertical. And but one thing is clear is your customers or your prospects will tell you. If you listen hard enough, they will tell you what is the right sales process you should have and what is the right value proposition they need. Mm-hmm. And that is what you get out of search mode. Usually out of scaling mode, you don't. I mean, for example, imagine, and Mary Lou, you've got a lot of experience, especially in call centers, but imagine selling a Fortune 500 and saying, oh no, you got to put a credit card on the website. That's the only way you can buy.
Right.
That sales process may be great for an SMB. I'm mm-hmm. exaggerating. But for a Fortune 500, they'll say, thank you. We don't even have credit cards.
Right.
We're going to send you a purchase order. Right. And the same thing goes the other way. Imagine if you tell a SMB, oh, the only way we can buy is you've got to sign, you got to put us through purchasing and you've got to give us a purchase order, otherwise we can't issue a quote. Otherwise we can't issue an invoice and so forth. So the whole processes are really the customer's processes. So I think one of the things that we've always had in all the startups I've worked for, mm-hmm. is we always try to focus on what is right for the customer, and you engineer the product for the customer, you engineer the sales process for the customer, you engineer the customer support process for the customer after the sale, you engineer the customer feedback. So you really are focusing on how can we keep adding value to that customer so that relationship keeps growing and becoming more and more valuable.
Now, the other thing I wanted to ask you about search mode, I'm a big stickler of metrics, of benchmarks, to generate consistency in the pipeline before we do anything of scale. Does that fall in here in search mode in some capacity? Are you also looking for consistent benchmarks that you could say, okay, we are now, you know, we understand from the buyer's journey where we should be. We pretty much have a good handle on the sales process and the sales conversations. Now we need to focus on how consistent is this framework for us, and can we fill pipeline more predictably? Is that something that's also in the search area for you?
Absolutely. It's absolutely in the search area. Typically, we have two or three people. Mm-hmm. When we do, if you take a look at sales, we have two or three people in sales, and maybe one or two SDRs to support them. So, a relatively small team. But basically, what we do is we validate how much does it cost me to generate a lead for them? How much does it cost me to generate a demo? So, and then is this really how the customers want to buy? Can we get to a profitable model? But even in search mode, we are measuring the cost of a demo, the cost of a lead, the cost of a closed deal, the number of deals each rep does. Because before we scale, we have to validate that each rep can do, let's say, four deals or five deals a month. Mm-hmm. We also validate the average deal size, right? So we validate all these metrics at a smaller scale. And most of the time when you're in the search mode, you don't get it, but maybe you want 1 or 2 months of consistency if you're dealing with SMB, and probably 1 or 2 quarters of consistency if you're dealing with enterprise. Right. But once you have these couple of months of consistencies, you're just replicating what you did. So part of search mode is getting close to capacity. And then once you're at capacity, you scale it. And then you tweak it, obviously, but you scale it.
So I think this is an area that I've seen over and over again that mistakes are being made. You know, there's just not a consistent amount of leads and opportunities in the pipeline that are forecastable. It's more like hope prospecting, you know, that, okay, we've got enough momentum, so now let's turn on the switch. But it really is doing a disservice by trying to do that. And then you end up backpedaling. You end up hiring all these people. There is no pipeline. And it's a classic problem that still is in our space today. And it was in our space in the early 80s when I started. just now we have more technology to really screw it up.
And the anecdote you mentioned about the being involved with the startup in Seattle, the venture-backed mm-hmm. startup, a lot of it comes from the venture capital nature of the investment, right? They want to see, okay, you've made a few dollars. Great, let's scale it. Now, you may have made a few dollars with each sale having gone through a different sales process, right?
Right.
You may have, I'm just picking a number. Let's say, like you said, $3 million. Mm-hmm. You could have closed $1 million. You could have closed a $100,000 deal. You could have closed a $2 million deal and a $900,000 deal. And each one went through a different sales process. Now, on paper, on the spreadsheet, that might look, okay, they did 3 million, let's go make them do 9 or whatever number they were asking. And without understanding the mechanics of it, and without understanding that how to validate these things. So I've been involved with a lot of these issues here, and the VCs, you know, make the assumption that you figured it out, and it's up to the management to be strong enough to say, okay, yeah, we figured out the segment. So this segment, we can probably, let's grow it to 3 million and let's see if there's still headroom because very well we may, you may be able to get leads enough from 3 to 6, but from 6 to 9, you may no longer have leads. Or for management to push back and say, look, we've done 3 different types of deals. One is a mid-market, one is an SMB, one is an enterprise. Let's pick one of them. Let's figure out how we can do 5 of these or 10 of these to make sure each one of these processes is repeatable, and then we can scale it. Because there's no point scaling it. And a lot of times you scale it without having figured out the process, and also with having a lot of slack on your sales capacity. So the problem is when you scale and you have a lot of slack, it ends up creating, you know, very bad morale because the sales reps aren't meeting target. Everybody's mm-hmm. stressed out about it and so forth.
Yeah, I think, you know, this comes back to our call center background, because at the time, call centers, telephony based, you lived and died by the list. There was a lot of, you know, painstaking attention paid to what source this lead was from and what it ended up closing as. So we had segmentation built in and lived by that for so long that when the internet came and you had like a free for all of records and email addresses and what have you, there wasn't that tight enough control over, you know, the type of account. I mean, even today, when I talk to people about the sources of leads and what's the mix, they look at me with just these like, I don't know, they don't know what I'm talking about. What do you mean by the source of a lead? What do you mean by a mix? And it's just amazing. But what you just said was, and which was the problem in Seattle, there was a total dollar amount that was generated, but no concern about where it came from, how long it took to generate, and whether it was segmented or not. It was just a number that they decided, let's triple it. You know, so you're right. And it still happens today. And it's just amazing to me with all the data tools and just all the apps that we have to have more control over this. It's like it is the wild, wild west still out there.
Right. It's the same comment I've seen from VCs all over the boardroom, but they seem to focus a lot on sales, maybe a little bit on marketing more than engineering, right?
Right.
Very rarely do they go to engineering and say, hey, listen, you've got to make this thing go 10 times faster, or you've got to do this thing. So, and it could be because a lot of the startups start with some sort of technology they bring up, which is already pretty impressive, but they seem to not worry about the profitability. They seem to worry about, hey, let's scale the top line and everything will be good, and without really understanding the mechanics of it. They're smart enough to understand that they don't understand the technology in most of the cases, so they don't push the engineers. But it's as if they had pushed the engineers to say, okay, I need you by next quarter to make it twice as fast. Right. But if you understand, I mean, you're a computer scientist, if you understand how hard it is to double the performance of a software program, mm-hmm. it's just as hard to double, if not harder to double, the performance of sales teams, especially if the process is not there.
Right. And you know, the cure for us would have been, let's look at the history of what closed. Let's look at the type of account that closed, the people involved. Do we even have those people in our database? I mean, there wasn't even any research done on whether we were equipped. So we spent the first quarter trying to get names, because the people that we found closed weren't necessarily represented in our database. I mean, I just had this, my co-author on the new book, we went and did an immersion program together. We created the ideal prospect persona. Her name was Betty. She was the one who was going to let us in the door. She was going to champion our project. So, you know, they were convinced. They had a huge list. They're a publicly held company. And there were enough Bettys in there to satisfy the team. Well, we did a search in the database. We did a search on LinkedIn. And LinkedIn was 10x the size of what we had in our database. And our database couldn't feed enough of the people to be able to have these conversations based on our metrics. So little simple things like that, just somehow, I don't know, they just get ignored, are not understood. But I think with your process of the search and scaling, there's some checks and balances there, almost like a checklist. Okay, you cannot pass go, you cannot collect $200 until you do, you know, these 3 things to make sure that you have a statistically relevant sampling of the type of account that is going to help you scale.
Oh, absolutely.
Like, and we've seen, me, but I don't know.
I've seen also, I was an investor in a company that got acquired. And they had great technology, but every one of their customers was different. It was almost a custom project for every one of the customers. Mm-hmm. So it was not a repeatable. It was not a repeatable sales process, but it wasn't even a repeatable product. And again, that was kind of hidden. So, and there's nothing wrong with that. It's just different expectations. There's nothing wrong with having a company that builds custom software for people, even if they have a kernel of technology, and take it from there. I mean, there's a lot of people doing great money this way. It's just a set of expectations and what you want to achieve.
So let's go back into the search mode. I'm curious about the sales messaging. Have you been able to quantify in some fashion when your sales messaging needs to change in an automated pipeline? And how that's actually done. What I'm asking is, you know, if we break out the pipeline, initial conversation, they let you in the door, now you're determining fit, and then from there you're going into some kind of qualification or disqualification process. I'm assuming that you have sales messaging that's supporting that conversation. When do you start taking that and tackling that in terms of getting it ready for scale?
So, I mean, I think you want to do it, and there's different messaging at the top of the funnel versus, in the middle of the funnel. Mm-hmm. So at the top of the funnel, you want to position so that people understand the problems you're solving. And then I would say more in the middle of the funnel, when people are comparing you to alternatives, right? You want to position how different you are and why that's important for the customer, right? And especially if you're going after a given segment with a given persona, why what you do is different than what the other people are. And you always have to validate this. I think you have to validate the top of the funnel and then the middle of the funnel messaging. And those are done very differently. Yes, the top of the funnel is how many demos you get, I would say maybe a metric to measure. However, in the middle of the funnel is how many deals you close versus competitors, right? Mm-hmm. For these kind of alternatives and these kind of personas. So those would be, I would say, the two metrics you would measure, and those are very different positionings. But you're always positioning your product in a very different way. So again, especially if you're doing outbound prospecting, you only have a few seconds to grab someone's attention. And it's probably not the right time to position yourself against competitors, because they may or may not be looking at competitors. The important thing at that point is the positioning of what is the problems you solve for that particular persona. And then once they've engaged with you in the sales cycle, they've done a demo, and maybe even before the demo, you do some research. So you've earned the right to get feedback from that customer to understand the problems and how your product can solve them or your service can solve them. And then you position how you would be a good fit for them, maybe against the competition.
Okay, because in the search mode, I also, one of the things I'm seeing a lot of that, you know, is proving to be very difficult is this concept of hyper-personalization. And they're in that search bucket, that's where I would experiment with what I call the three levels of personalization, which is, you know, mass personalization, data-driven, which it has some knowledge, has to have a richer database in order to know more about the prospect from a predictive or prescriptive analytic point of view, and then hyper-personalization, where they're actually physically editing everything that they do and sending out the emails or whatever, their voicemail scripts, whatever. But in the search mode, that I think would be a perfect place to start validating whether this hyper-personalization craze is really helping or hurting production. Because I think if you move a hyper-personalized approach that's at a smaller scale to a larger scale, it just brings on a whole slew of new problems.
Oh, yeah. And then the question is, can you can probably do, like, for instance, now if I'm going to prospect to you, Mary Lou, next month, I can probably hyper-personalize it. Mm-hmm. But how scalable is that, right? It's within my network, but then beyond my network, I probably won't be able to hyper-personalize it. So that's also something to take into account.
Definitely. I mean, in my world, I can hyper-personalize because working with the end in mind, my goal for opportunity is very low because it's me. You know, I don't have a team here of people that I'm feeding to make sure that we get enough opportunities in. So I can, because of my overall record size, my overall universe, but I still use templates. I still start everything with templates that has my value proposition, you know, why me, why now, why this type of scenario of putting in a sales process. And then I customize as needed. But for the most part, I rely very heavily on data-driven personalization, because I think if you wrap up your calls, here's us going back to the telephony side of things. If you wrap up your calls, if you've had conversations with personas that look like the one you're going after, you're going to have a better idea of how to frame that conversation for the next time you have this role that you're working on. And since I have three roles in my world, I pretty much understand what the logical progression is of urgency in solving problems and which problems bubble up to the top, even at what time of year, you know, they bubble up. Usually it's crazy around here, fourth quarter or third quarter, because people are trying to make their numbers and think we can just miraculously put in a process that works and that will generate, you know, 2-3x. So I have that set. It's all rhythmic, but it's all using data to do that and still that authentic approach.
Yeah, I mean, I think you always have to be authentic, and I think it's a combination. How do you use data and stay authentic? And it sounds like from your engineering perspective, you're very structured, and you're absolutely right. I mean, some things, I don't know if you want to put it in the personalization bucket. If you even use the same vocabulary of certain people, for instance, you know, one of the things that we do and we've done in the past is, we used to convince CFOs to prepay a couple of years in front, mm-hmm. and in exchange for a discount. And basically we would talk about them about, the IRR, the return on this investment, how much they could get in the bank. Yep. And so, you know, at the time they were getting like 0.1% in the bank, and hey, what if we give you 10% discount? Is that better than keeping it in the bank? So for Fortune 500s, it was a no brainer. Right. But again, that message would have totally flown over our end user. So I do agree that there's a level of personalization for personas, mm-hmm. and there's a level on a personal level even more if you can get that. I mean, I think we see a lot of AI happening right now, mm-hmm. that are doing kind of the top of the funnel personalization. Right. Sometimes in emails, I mean, you see products a bit like Conversica that automate email at the top of the funnel. And I think, you know, they're going to be somewhat successful there at the top. But I think the middle and the bottom of the funnel is really where humans will excel. And this is what we're doing at Frontspin. We're building tools for them to be as productive as possible in that part of the funnel.
Yeah, I agree. And getting back to your, well, we call that language, but we house, again, just coming back from wrapping up the call properly, we house the language, the way they spoke to us, the pain points that resonated, positionally where those pain points entered in relative position in the pipeline. If were we at the first call, were we at the pre-conversation level? And so all of that data that we can store in our database helps build the correct sales conversation. And if with tools like Conversica that are going to come in and take that and actually frame it out even more so for us, the phone is going to become extreme and is still extremely important with those one-to-one sales conversations. But that's a topic of another podcast I'll have to have you back on.
Thank you, Mary Lou.
We've already gone over our time, but I wanted to leave the audience with, you know, I'll put on the topic page for this podcast your connection information to Frontspin. I recommend that people take a look at that product because it is, you know, it really is an amazing product that helps you have better conversations. They're, just so you know, their metrics are double what Aaron and I did in 2011 with predictable revenue. We were hoping to get 3 to 5 meaningful conversations in a 2-hour call block. And, you know, Monster's company blows that out of the water. So it's worth taking a look at that. How else would you like people to get a hold of you, Monster?
So they can look me up on LinkedIn. If on the blog, on the podcast, you put in my my name. You can look me up on LinkedIn. Be glad to connect. And obviously on our website, www.frontspin.com, there's a number of ways to get a hold of us. If you want to take a look at the product and see if we can be helpful, or even if there's any questions you guys may have, we'd be glad to have my team routed to me or address it directly.
Great. Well, thank you so much. This has been very enlightening. I think a lot of people really need to think about this whole process of scaling. And, you know, next time you're sitting in a board meeting and there's a number thrown out, you have the ammunition to give them all the reasons why you need to take it back, do some analysis and research before you agree to that crazy number that they're putting up there.
Absolutely.
Thanks again, Mansoor.
Thank you, Mary Lou.